You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary. To the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.
Hello everyone and welcome to a History of the Great War interview. On this interview, I was joined by Dr. Chris Kemshall to discuss his work on how the First World War is portrayed in video games, and how that can both help and hinder interest and understanding for the players of those games. Video games and their relation to history is a topic that is very personally important to me. When I was quite young, my family got a copy of Civilization II, and the game and the content in it sort of really ignited something in my brain. It is the first time I can remember transitioning from a piece of historical entertainment being just interesting to causing me to wanting to actively learn more about its subject matter. It was the Legion unit that sent me into this research spiral, which was quite a bit more challenging in the days before the internet. While Civilization II was the beginning, over the years and then decades, games based on history would occupy a large percentage of my gaming time, which was my primary hobby for many years. Age of Empires, Total War, Company of Heroes, and many, many more. It's only somewhat recently, honestly around the time that I started History of the Great War in 2014, that I began to consider how important the history showcased within video games really was. Video games, just like movies, TV shows, and books, have massive audiences, into the millions, and the consumers of video games represent a wide and incredibly diverse cross-section of society. For many, what they see in various video games might be their only exposure to that era of history, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Video games as a medium brings with it a special set of challenges when it comes to representing history, but there are challenges in every type of medium. Books, movies, and television all have their own particular blends of strengths and weaknesses. It can often be tempting to underestimate the impact of content choices made within games and the impact those choices can have. There's probably an entire book to be written about how specific misconceptions about history have both fed into games made about those time periods, and also how those games have then perpetuated and shifted those misconceptions. Dr. Kemshall brings this up, and maybe brings up the best example in the interview, and also in his book, as it relates to the First World War. And that's the idea that the commanders in the war, especially on the Western Front, were simply idiots for doing what they did. This incredibly negative view of their actions is something I've argued against in the podcast several times, not because they did not make bad decisions, they made some real bad decisions, but because often those criticisms use knowledge of later events to criticize earlier decisions. We know that the Battle of the Frontiers would be an absolute debacle for the French, but they certainly did not believe that would happen. And they had good reasons for those beliefs, beliefs based on assumptions of what combat would look like in a future war, that just so happened to be wrong. Video games then provide the player with the ability to go back in time, with the knowledge that those attacks failed, and route history around them and onto a different path. This can also feed into the idea that, especially in the First World War, it was one person making decisions and one person driving events, which even when decision-making power rested with one person, there were whole hosts of people feeding them information, and even more people who had to execute on those decisions. These nuances are often lost when decisions are reduced to hexes, and all those individuals who can and will make mistakes are reduced to little square chits. These are just a few of the challenges presented by taking history and representing it in an interactive and player-driven medium. I think that such criticisms are the easy thing to level against games that are set within a period of history, in the same way that it's easy to criticize movies that play a bit fast and loose with the source time period. I'm looking at you, Patriot. It gets more interesting and involved when you start thinking about why specific content decisions were made, and what that says about events like the First World War within society. How games represent the popular thinking on the First World War at the time of their creation is an interesting piece of the evolving perceptions of the war. How do they represent the puzzle of the Western Front? Do they fall into portraying the military leaders in that classic and dated lions led by donkeys mentality? Is it an English language game that moves the narrative outside of the typical list of topics, the naval war of Somme and Ypres and Gallipoli? Video games, for all their positives and negatives, are rarely going to push the understanding of history forward in any real way, but they can provide us a glimpse into how events of the past are viewed and interacted with at a snapshot in time. Are they perfect? Absolutely not. But often, although just like every other form of entertainment, not always, they can use their position as one of the most popular and pervasive entertainment products of the 21st century to remind a new generation that the First World War is an event worth remembering, and maybe just an event worth learning more about. I have firsthand experience with how the content of video games can greatly impact people with little knowledge of specific time periods in history. I've received multiple emails, Facebook comments, and tweets over the years where people found the podcast because they were playing a video game, and it ignited an interest in the First World War, and they wanted to find out more information. It came from people playing Valiant Hearts and wanting to learn more about the French experiences, and people who had played one of the many strategic and operational strategy games and wanted to find out more about the global situation, people who picked up the first-person shooter Verdun on Steam, and people who had no idea that the Italian front existed before Battlefield 1. Those types of things are happening all the time. There is somebody out there always having their Civilization 2 Legion moment, just like I did. Not everything in video games is helpful to the understanding of history. Some of it is actively harmful, which they should be held accountable for, just like any other form of popular entertainment. But they can be a gateway to further understanding, and hopefully that means they are a net positive. On a programming note, during the following interview, I ask a question about Star Wars about 43 minutes into the podcast runtime. If you are not here for Star Wars talk, which is completely understandable considering this is not a Star Wars podcast, we do not return to a First World War discussion for the remainder of the episode. I will not feel bad in any way if you just hit the Marcus Played button and move on. With that said, let's jump into the interview.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a History of the Great War interview. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Krish Kimshal, the author of The First World War in Computer Games and British, French, and American Relations on the Western Front, 1914 to 1918. Dr. Kimshal is also currently working on a book that has nothing to do with any of that, but we'll get to that later. Hello, Dr. Kimshal. How's it going today?
Thank you for having me. Yeah, it's good. I've been looking forward to this.
Excellent, excellent. So in the past, and sort of the reason I guess you're here, is that you've taught an entire course on the First World War at the university level that used video games as part of its content. How did that get started? What do you look for in the gaming experiences that you chose to feature?
The starting point for it, to an extent, had always been, I'd done snapshots of it. So when I taught the First World War previously at other universities, you know, there'd be a big course on the First World War, I might, if I was lucky, get a week in on computer games or tell my students to go away and play some computer games. And in those instances, it was, the focus was often on something, okay, this might not necessarily be the best game, but is there an element about it that I think is interesting or indicative of a wider trend? Now, a game that I used to use a lot until, depressingly, they took it down, is a game that I hate with every fiber of my being and love at the same time. It's a game called Trench Warfare that used to be on the BBC educational website, and it was the most ahistorical nonsense, as well as being a genuinely bad computer game you're ever likely to encounter. But it was a perfect way of examining a particular popular view of the First World War, in that it's all death, it's all horror, and it can't be won, because the game itself couldn't be won. You get to the final level and it couldn't be completed, and then the game would go, only a monster would try and complete this level after this, at which point you automatically start hammering the replay button, because you can't tell a computer game you can't do something, and the game just continually judges you for it. So I used to get my students play things like that to then come back and go, okay, let's talk about the popular understanding of the First World War, because that game was awful and it was annoying, and I kind of like annoying my students in weird ways like that. So it played into all of those things. And then where I was teaching at the Bader International Study Center most recently, I had the opportunity of doing an entire course about First World War computer games. And this was something I'd never had the chance to do before. So I thought, okay, how would I break this down? And it was things like, okay, I want to do a week on, you know, soldiers fighting and killing. And the way that would work is there would be two seminars in that week, one of which would be focused on computer games. So, you know, go away and play Battlefield 1, or go away and play Valiant Hearts, or go away and play Verdun, and interact in some way with images of soldiers and images of death, images of killing. Then we'll come back and we'll talk about it. And then in the second seminar is, okay, now let's break out some archival documents. Let's look at what soldiers actually thought about their wartime services. And how do these two ideas, the computer game portrayal and the archival explanation, interact with each other? Where were the difficulties? Where were the tensions? And that was effectively the model for the course, of finding games like that that could be indicative of wider moments, be it soldiers or be it race or be it empire, or be it flight, you know, something you could hook onto to then talk about both games and the realities of that wartime experience in whatever form it took.
Interesting. So it's interesting that you were able to sort of build video games into a curriculum like that and use it to compare how things are shown in modern media to maybe how they really were. Video games are not typically a media used in history curriculum, as far as I know. Do you think that's kind of just a function of how relatively new they are as a form of media? Is there some other reason, or is this just like a generational problem that, you know, in a decade may be very different?
I think the answer is all of the above. So, I mean, the first thing to acknowledge is that where I was doing this, whilst I was teaching it in England, it was as part of a study abroad center for a Canadian university. A North American university teaching is very, very different to British or European teaching, to the extent that my understanding of it is that in North American universities, when it comes to doing elements of curriculum design and the like, once it's signed off, the lecturer is basically God. They can do whatever they want. And I had my course signed off, and as a result, I did whatever I wanted. At English universities, you've got to jump through like 12 different committees before you're allowed to even, like, you know, draw a picture of what you might want to teach a student. So the North American model gave me an awful lot more kind of freedom in those ways. But history departments as a whole, certainly in Britain, despite the fact that, you know, I've worked at a variety of them, I've got friends working at them, that there is an element that they tend towards the conservative with a small c. And computer games are new, and I mean, even that I don't necessarily agree. I'm actually not going to immediately contradict with myself. Computer games are not new. I'm 37 years old. I'm going to be 38 this year, and I have had interactions with computer games for almost my entire life. They're not new in the sense that they got invented yesterday, but I think they lack an element of kind of institutionally applied validity to them. I mean, you know, some history departments and some kind of elements of history are only just getting on board with studying film and television. Computer games is way too early a medium for such a thing. So there is resistance to them. I'm hoping that that type of thing will kind of die out a little bit. I mean, you know, there's a whole generation of historians like my age or younger who have only ever known computer games and believe them to be a valuable resource for the study of history, but also all of our students play them. If for no other reason than that, we should be examining them in universities. You know, if there was a whole cohort of students coming up who'd all read the same history book, universities would expect their staff to have at least a passing familiarity with what is in that history book. And a lot of people, I would imagine, who have studied the First World War at university recently, and certainly the people who've taught it at university recently, would have been interacting with students who played Battlefield 1, because, you know, damn near everybody played Battlefield 1 who was interested in history and was a computer gamer. So I'd like to think that that's going to get better. You know, I'd like to think it's going to get better in time for me to have a long and burgeoning career. But if not, maybe the people coming up behind are going to have a whale of a time. But you'd like to think it's something he's going to give at some point.
Maybe your book will be one of those texts that constantly gets cited in works forever now, from
yeah,
now.
Like 20 years after I'm dead.
This person, like 50 years ago, they knew what was up. Too bad they,
if only he was alive to see it today.
Yeah, I love the Battlefield 1 example. You know, as a person who started a World War One history podcast in 2014 and also has been a big fan of Battlefield and history games in general, I had multiple people reach out to me of like, oh yeah, I found your podcast because I played Battlefield 1 and I didn't even know that they fought in Italy, and I've learned so much. It was a really interesting experience to be on the receiving end of people who had played that game and wanted to learn more.
Yeah, Battlefield 1 is a really good example of a gateway game. I mean, you know, let's be honest, a fair chunk of the player base played the game, enjoyed it, then went on and got on with their lives. But we're talking about millions and millions of people here. So a significant proportion, even 1% of those people, is still, 40,000 people, potentially, if you take it from 4 million downwards, would have then gone away and found out something about the First World War. And I had, it was anecdotal, so I wasn't able to kind of properly include it in anything. But during the centenary years, the Imperial War Museum did a big project called Lives of the First World War, where you could go in and they basically created like a holding page for every soldier who served in the British Army, and family members could upload photos, and diary stuff, and biography and the like, and get this whole kind of rounded image of an individual set amongst, you know, 5 million other individuals. And somebody at the Imperial War Museum told me that when Battlefield 1 came out, the Lives of the First World War website got the most hits it had ever had by people who began going into the Lives of the First World War and typing in the names of the characters that they'd played in Battlefield 1. Now, they're all fictional, so they didn't find anything, but that alone is a clear indication that there was an interest there to go and find more.
That's really interesting to hear. Maybe there was some collaboration that could have been done on that to make sure that those results came back to something.
Oh, God, the number of missed opportunities that have sailed by in regards to First World War computer games and kind of museums and First World War academia and the like is, I mean, it's not surprising, but it is a little kind of, oh, yeah, that would have been great. But that was years ago. That opportunity's gone. Maybe next time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. One of the items you discuss in your book is that First World War, on the strategy game side of things, instead of on maybe the first-person shooter side, gives players a chance to kind of play out the war correctly, or what we consider today to be more correct than what they did, or the wrong way that they did it at the time. It's often leveled at leaders, especially military leaders at that time, that they were, you know, doing things wrong. Could you talk about a few examples of how they do this? And do you think they do it well? And do you think it provides like a productive way to look at the history?
That is a really good question. I think to begin answering with your final question first, not particularly. I don't think it particularly gives a productive way of dealing with it, because the concept and the portrayal of any strategy game against the reality of, you know, whether we're talking, you know, Rome Total War all the way up to Hearts of Iron or something like that, is always completely kind of removed from the reality of, you know, Caesar's battles or commanding the Soviet Union during the Second World War. Because strategy games give you a level of oversight, power and control that cannot possibly exist. I mean, you see all of your battles from the air in real time. You know, you want to do something, you send an order to a guy and they do it immediately. It's not a kind of a case of, okay, all right, my right flank of Roman legionnaires is starting to cave in a little bit, so I'll send in some reinforcements. I'll just send a runner who will, you know, gallop across the screen in real time to deliver the order or anything like that. It's always instantaneous. But what ends up happening in First World War versions of these strategy games is you approach them with this lines led by donkeys starting point, you know, particularly around figures like Field Marshal Haig, of a man who is popularly considered to be incompetent, at best, murderous at worst, and that the First World War ended not through any kind of actual military victory, but basically because everyone was a bit tired and the Germans were slightly more tired, and therefore they lost. There's a brilliant quote by, I think it's by Dennis Showalter, talking about the myth of attrition warfare, which posits that if you to believe that the way that attrition is written about, that the war will end when the last three surviving French and British soldiers totter on aged legs across no man's land to bayonet the last two surviving Germans. It's that kind of level of approach to it, that the First World War is not won by military means. It's won in spite of the efforts of generals. Therefore, if you now place a player into this scenario, can you actually know? Can you solve a problem like the Western Front? Can you be smarter than Haig? Can you be smarter than Foch or Ludendorff or any of these guys? And what they then give you the opportunity to do is basically to rewrite history. There's a huge counterfactual element to these strategy games where, you know, you don't want to get bogged down in trenches, or, you know that tanks and planes are the thing to do. So why not just build more of those? Why weren't they building tanks and planes in 1914? Well, you know, tanks hadn't been invented yet. So you end up with that kind of time ahistorical, asynchronous element. But what I think the weird element of strategy games is that rather than really allowing the player to challenge the idea of lines led by donkeys, they just basically reproduce it. Because I know it's not real. I know it's a computer game. I know that they're little pixel guys. But I swear to God, I have never cared about the lives of the men I've sent into battle on any strategy game I have ever played. I don't care that, you know, Dave on the front line's got a wife and a family at home, and little Timmy hopes to see him for Christmas. If Dave's got to die to move me 5 inches closer to my objective, then Dave is going to die. And what is that, if not the popular satirical commentary of First World War generals, that you will just throw waves and waves of your own men into a problem? There's always more that can be built. There's always more lives that can be churned out from a little pixelated factory somewhere. And you reproduce this Haigian image of the First World War general just throwing men at a problem. And I find that really weird and kind of a little unsettling.
That's really good. And you fall into, because just thinking about the thought process for a lot of strategy games, it's not so much what happens to your people. It's you're criticizing them because even though they were killed, they didn't take enough of the enemy with them to make your plans work.
Yeah, absolutely. I would have won that battle if my men had shown a little bit more devotion to the greater victory. Regardless of whether or not they were being shelled by shrapnel at the time, if they'd have just, you know, taken a little bit more of the French offensive à outrance approach, you know, strapped on the bayonets and just gone for blood, then maybe this whole thing would have panned out differently. As a result, none of them are going home for Christmas. But it's fine because they're only pixels and it doesn't matter. In the same way that, you know, they're just figures on a casualty register, it doesn't matter. This weird echo backwards and forwards of you are uncaring about the lives of those under you because they're not real in some way.
Interesting. It almost like makes you think you are being incredibly different than the past. You are fixing all the problems of the past, when in reality, because it's a computer game and there are sort of shortcomings in that, it makes you fall into it even more because you are trying to skip ahead on solutions that they didn't have at the time. You thought you know that planes are the way to go, so you put a bunch of time and effort into planes or in-game resources into planes, but you can only accelerate it so much, you don't have everything else around it, and then also you just don't care about the people that you're sending in.
Yeah, and you, as you say, you literally try and game the outcome of it because, you know, oh, equally, you don't want to just sit there not fighting any battles. That's not the point of a strategy game. Even whilst you're waiting for, you know, your 500th plane to roll off of the factory or your 2000th tank, you're gonna want to get stuck in at some point. So you'll fight a pointless battle because it gives you something to do. And, you know, you can try and kind of min-max the statistics in that of it, but at some level, you're going to end up fighting battles and people are going to end up getting killed. You can tell yourself that you're doing it because, you know, you've got a genius plan and a genius strategy, but, you know, that's what the guys at the time would have thought as well. You know, they were fighting battles in a manner that was to kind of quote the Clausewitz approach of strategy is of, you know, the use of the battle for the purposes of the war. You know, you're going to fight a battle because it's going to give you a favourable outcome in the wider theatre. Well, I have fought a lot of battles in strategy games. They have not all been for the purposes of the wider war. Sometimes they've been out of spite or because I need to trim down my army somewhat and I want better troops. And if that means that some of my lesser troops have to die in service for my aims, then that's what you're going to do. But it ends up as that kind of weird. I mean, you know, you can go overly philosophical on it. And, you know, as I said before, it is a computer game. It isn't real. But I do find that a really weirdly interesting dynamic that actually reproduces that which it's telling the player it will circumvent.
Along with that, you know, when I think about things that First World War video games are bad at portraying or portray quite badly, I think of kind of two things, and you mentioned time in your book, you mentioned time, and you kind of talk about shortcomings with time. I think about artillery and how I feel like no computer game has ever gotten First World War artillery correct or right, probably on purpose because it creates gameplay problems. Are there other frequent shortcomings that you think video games as a medium could perhaps improve on when they look at the First World War and could maybe help to better move towards a better understanding of history?
I think your artillery example is a really, really good one because, you know, if artillery was depicted really, really well, it would end a lot of First World War computer games, particularly first-person shooter ones, because you are going to go over the top and then something very, very horrible is going to happen to you and reload and try again. There are other things that computer games, particularly First World War computer games, are bad at, but they often tie into wider societal issues, you know, in regards to kind of popular culture or popular memory that is all equally bad at explaining. And the one that always comes predominantly to my mind is, what is the war for and why does it end? Now, we can remove computer games immediately from the equation and ask, you know, is kind of British society or American society particularly good at explaining why the First World War happens and why it ends? And I think the answer to both of those is probably no. You either end up with an element of kind of Christopher Clark's The Sleepwalkers of everybody kind of fell into each other at the top of some stairs, rolled down in at the bottom, there was a war, and they didn't really understand what was happening. Or that kind of wider alliance system. I mean, you know, you might get a bit of Fritz Fischer about, you know, it was the Germans' fault, really. But there's no real understanding within our culture of why the war happens, except for, you know, it's an accident, it's a tragedy, it should never have happened. And it ends because everybody's tired. Now, neither of those two things are really true. You know, there's plenty of historiography explaining why, or varying kind of interpretations of why the First World War begins, and lots about the kind of the military battles, and particularly the Hundred Days that bring about its conclusion. But First World War computer games don't really include any of that. Even games like Battlefield 1 basically pay passing memo to, oh, you know, it was a clash of empires. So, well, yeah, but there's an awful lot of reasons for why this conflict is happening. But because it's difficult to explain and it's complicated, what you end up doing is basically ignoring it altogether and just zooming in on, you know, this soldier in this trench doesn't care why the war happened. He's just there to live through it, which is, you know, true up to a point. But these are societies that get mobilized in 1914 and 1915. You know, those soldiers are aware of why it is that they're there, particularly the French ones. You know, their country's been invaded. The German ones are, particularly after the failures to knock France and Russia out of the war early on, have, you know, very clear reasons why they're sticking at it. The British have reasonably clear reasons why they're sticking at it. But computer games are bad at explaining this, so they just basically sidestep it altogether. And as the other kind of half of that bracket is, they're then terrible at explaining why the war ends. It just seems to be that, again, everyone got tired, the last guy standing, and they're the winners. And I think to be able to do a better service to telling the stories that computer games want to tell, they need to get better at framing the context of where these stories are taking place. You can tell a story about a clash of empires, about, you know, the Entente Cordiale and the Central Powers and fears of, you know, imperial collapse or channel ports or any of those things without, you know, having to get into the actual weeds of it. But if you can create a time period, a context when these things are real, it makes it an awful lot easier for you to then talk about what it's like to live in those circumstances. You know, what does it mean to be a French soldier on the Western Front in a time period, say 1916, you're fighting at Verdun endlessly, your family's living in occupied France, or you haven't been home on leave in a year or so. You know, there is narrative dramatic potential in that. But you only get the narrative and dramatic potential if you can frame why it's happening at all. And I desperately hope that computer games will get better at that, because they've never had any problems talking about why the Second World War began or why the Second World War ended. I mean, admittedly, you know, it's a sexier conflict, if you want. But the example still stands. If you can do it for one, you should be able to do it for the other.
It's interesting. I've never really thought about it that way, in that, you know, video games have shortcomings in how they portray history of any period, First World War included. But for the First World War, it is kind of just a lens through which the common perceptions of the war in general are portrayed incorrectly. It's sort of modified maybe by video game realities or computer game realities. But that's interesting. I've never really thought of it that way.
Yeah, I think it's that kind of that reproduction of things that we kind of already know. And I having gone through all of that, me saying, oh, you know, I think computer games need to do a better job. The fact that, you know, most media does a pretty bad job of explaining why the war happens and why it ends, it's entirely possible, and I've said this in kind of other bits and pieces, that actually the responsibility of this might lay on historians rather than computer game developers or media creators. If we're not doing a good enough job of explaining these things, we can't then be a little bit upset when media doesn't properly reproduce it to our satisfaction. You know, if we're going to rely on, you know, EA Dice to tell history for us, then we're going to have to live with what we get. And we're going to have to be happy with it, particularly if we're not going to get involved in the process. You know, EA Dice could come and ask us, and you know, that'd be nice, given some of the things that have appeared in historical computer games over the not kind of particularly recent past, or not too distant past, rather, that, you know, maybe talking to historians might save you an awful lot of bad press, guys. Just a thought. But yeah, unless historians actually get involved in the process or make themselves available for the process, then all of this information that we carry around in our head or our incredibly expensive books isn't going to make it into the mainstream. And I think that was a kind of a wiser thing that appeared out of the First World War centenary. I know a kind of various historians you know, some of them, like, kind of even friends and colleagues, are like, were left a bit dissatisfied by the centenary because they didn't think that the vision that existed in popular culture or popular memory of the First World War was shifted enough. And I think some of that is absolutely true. And I think some of that can be said, kind of attributed by the fact that, you know, sometimes people don't want to hear it. It's very difficult to tell the public something, you know, a dramatic change in history that they're not willing to get on board with. But also some of it, you know, myself included, I wonder how available we made ourselves and our research to try and move these things forward enough. And, you know, if there is an argument to be made that the First World War centenary didn't do enough to change the way that people in Britain or Europe or the world thought about the First World War, then, you know, some of that responsibility has got to land on the shoulder of First World War historians. Because, you know, if it didn't move enough, it's because we didn't move it enough.
As a person who has very delicately handled a $250 book on my desk while researching, yeah, maybe availability of research maybe is not the best.
Yeah, and yeah, that's why things like these podcasts are actually really good fun, because, you know, we're the best will in the world. You know, if anybody wants to go out and buy my book and wants to get out, like, a, you know, a second mortgage or something before you go and do it, then by all means, please be my guest. But in this sense, we can have a conversation about stuff. We can, you know, I can tell people about some of the ideas that appear in the book without them having to go out and, you know, sell a child in order to buy it, which, you know, it's got to be a good thing for everybody.
I realize now, kind of as we're talking, we're 26 plus minutes in here. We've been very negative. So I wanted to throw in a question about positivity about sort of computer games and what they bring to understanding history. I think because of my own past, you know, kind of go off on a little anecdote here. As a child, my interest in history kind of started with computer games. Civilization 2 is the first game I remember really connecting with and wanting to learn more about the legionnaires that I was building as the Romans, for example. And then that went through Total War, that went through several other games sort of over the years. And so I think of engagement, I think of just raw numbers of people thinking about and interacting with history as one of the big benefits of computer games. Are there other ones that you can think of that, you know, aren't quite so negative about the media that's created?
Yeah, I mean, I similarly have a story of Civilization 2. I absolutely adored that game, to the extent I didn't play another Civilization game until like Civilization 5, because it just wasn't Civilization 2.
Exactly the same. I still haven't played another one in any real way.
Yeah, because the classic was so beautiful. And I think you're right, we have been fairly negative. And, you know, this is going to come up, I suspect, in a future question. It's that kind of, you criticize something because you love it. You know, I love computer games. I love many, many First World War computer games. And that kind of critique of them comes from a place of engagement. And there are some things that First World War computer games have done fabulously well. You know, there are lots and lots of things that we could say about Battlefield 1. But the thing that I often say is that if somebody had come up to me at the beginning of the centenary and said, the most popular media event of the next 4 years will involve people, millions and millions and millions of people, playing as an Italian soldier fighting the Austro-Hungarians in the Dolomites and loving it, I'd have laughed in your face. And that is never, ever going to happen. No one cares about the Italian front in modern European popular culture of the First World War. But the geographic spread of games like Battlefield 1 has been fantastic. You know, Verdun did the Western Front. Then they moved on to Tannenberg with their expansion for the Eastern Front. They're now doing one about the Italian front as well. You know, the geography of the First World War is being expanded by these games in ways that has never happened in any other form of media. And I think that has to be acknowledged and appreciated, that, you know, the first time that many people were going to find out that Italy was part of the First World War is playing Battlefield 1. That's fantastic. My friend Vander Wilcox does Italian histories of the First World War. And I know that, you know, she's found that a hugely interesting kind of moment. First World War games have also told some beautiful stories. I will go to my deathbed praising Valiant Hearts with my whole heart. It is a beautiful, gorgeous, moving portrayal of experiences in the First World War far more interesting and emotionally resonant than I think many other forms of modern media have ever come close to in dealing with the conflict. The way that they took the events of the First World War was focusing largely on the French aspect. What I think made it so successful was the fact that most people in Britain don't know anything about the French experience of the First World War, which means that there are particular moments in that game, without getting into spoilers, that are going to be deeply shocking to the game.
Yes, absolutely. And I also agree on the French experiences, maybe not getting enough exposure in English. Again, as a person who has tried to read about French experiences and only speaks English, it is a shockingly short sort of a source pool to pull from.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got a book for that if it's of interest for you, for the French experience. But yeah, you know, the British popular memory of the war is focused largely on five white guys called George. There's no room for the Allies. There's up until the centenary, there was scarcely an acknowledgement that the British Empire had been a thing during the war, which means that, you know, when you play through certain levels of Valiant Hearts and you see what's happening in the French army and what that means for some of the characters, it comes completely out of nowhere for you. It has a tremendous kind of emotional punch to it. And that is a really interesting aspect of the First World War computer game ability, to play on the blind spots and effectively the kind of societal ignorance, not in a bad way of societal ignorance, you know, so it's suggesting that, you know, the gamers have done something wrong. But if you haven't read about it and you haven't been taught about it, then, you know, it doesn't exist for you. That's fine. You know, everybody's ignorant about something until they find out about it for the first time. And that's what Valiant Hearts was able to do. And there are even some really interesting games coming up. There's a game coming up, I can't remember what it's called, but it's been developed by a Polish studio, I think, which is focused on being a doctor at a casualty clearing station. The idea is, you know, computer games are normally about how many soldiers can you kill, but now how many soldiers can you save? What a fantastic idea for a computer game. What a fantastic idea for something, for a way to approach the First World War than through, you know, can you save the lives of soldiers coming back from the front? You know, I imagine when we play it, there'll be any number of kind of slightly historical issues and accuracy moments in an authentic one. But I don't care. I'm already super interested in this idea of a way to interact with the First World War. And if, again, you know, if 1% of the audience who play it go out and read, you know, a book by Jessica Meyer or by Joanna Bourne or similar, then that's just a huge win for the historical field.
I could not agree more, for sure. Do you think, you know, a lot of what we've talked about with the positives there are sort of in these very zoomed in experiences, but I think the bulk of probably First World War set computer games are more of the strategy variety, where I kind of find it a slightly more difficult to find good history or good learning opportunities in. Do you have similar problems, or I could totally be missing something?
Yeah, I think I do, up to a point. What I think is really interesting is to the extent to which strategy games weren't a thing during the centenary. I can't think of any that were really, I mean, there were mods in that was made, but I can't think of any First World War strategy games really developed during the First World War centenary. It was all a mix of things like Battlefield 1 or Verdun, or more kind of narrative adventure games like Valiant Hearts. And I wonder if that's going to become an ongoing trend, because my big fear at the end of centenary was that everyone, like a bunch of computer game developers, well, you know, that was fun for 4 years, but let's go back to the Second World War again. It's like, oh God, please don't. But what appears to be coming out is that, you know, whilst the likes of Battlefield, you know, wandered back off into the Second World War and the like, and I have no doubt that in 10 years' time they'll end up back in, you know, Jon Snow in space, whatever that horrendous future warfare monstrosity was. That I can't even remember if it was a Battlefield or a Call of Duty game. It was something dreadful. The narrative potential of the First World War will endure, and that might squeeze strategy games out of the kind of the field for it. It's already a bit of a tough ask for strategy games, because you either go, you know, I'm going to make a historical strategy game. Oh God, here come Creative Assembly with a Total War franchise. They're going to crush me like a bug unless I sink more money into this than I will ever own in my entire life. Or, you know what, I'll take a slightly different approach to it. And, you know, it's not going to be about controlling units in real time. It's going to be about an overview. And oh, now, fantastic, I've landed in Paradox, is Hearts of Iron, and they're going to crush me like a bug unless I spend more money than I possibly got. So I wonder if it's a wider trend in strategy games that actually these kind of behemoth Total War, Hearts of Iron franchises have squeezed them out already of a lot of their kind of space for this type of stuff. And the Centenary was just a reflection of that, that there just wasn't room or an interest or a desire to try and tackle the First World War in a strategy game.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when it comes to appeal, you have a big mountain to climb, I think, in terms of how you're representing at a strategy level, at sort of a strategic level or operational level, how you're representing things and how much the Western Front can move if you want to be at all historical about how you're doing things.
Yeah, and that's a big problem. I think it comes up a bit in the book that, you know, try to actually recreate trench warfare as by creating a scenario where nothing moves is a challenge for strategy game designers. I don't think they've come close to cracking it yet.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of the ones I've played or I've watched played or interacted with really fall back on that attrition piece of it, where it's, oh, you're just going to keep putting chits on the board as long as you've got reserves until you're both out, and then you can finally do something.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the computer gaming of attrition warfare.
So that's great. We've had a lot of great conversations about the First World War. Let's talk about your next project. As a fan of... I've been a lifelong fan of Star Wars, but I will say my reevaluations of Star Wars and perhaps the history and most importantly its politics has maybe slightly soured me on the old Star Wars over the last several years. So what is this new book you're working on, and how did you get from First World War to Star Wars?
So, we finally move on to some serious historical scholarship. the new book, which I am finishing at the moment, as in it will be, I don't want to date the podcast, but it will be submitted within weeks of this recording, is called History and Politics in the Star Wars Universe. And again, it has to be kind of pointed out that much like the computer games, it's the critique is coming from a place of love. You know, I love and adore Star Wars, and, you know, grew up with it similar to you. But before we get into the content of it, you know, how did I get to it? Effectively, through First World War computer games. So I did the book that we've been talking about, and I did an article that kind of came out at the same time called Pixel Irons, which was about the portrayal of soldiers in First World War computer games. And that got picked up by the Great War YouTube channel, who I imagine a fair number of your listeners will have heard about, and they shared it. And the reads for it went, you know, through the roof. You know, thousands of people read it. And it flagged up all sorts of kind of sirens and alarms at Taylor and Francis and Routledge, and their history editor said, oh, you know, this article did really well. Have you got any other ideas for things you might want to, you know, write about? And I was like, well, are you talking like history things or geeky things? And he was like, yeah, whichever. It's like, well, I do have a geeky idea that I'd like to write about. And it was, it was a kind of a military history of the Star Wars world, but it kind of morphed into a proper examination of what does, when Star Wars talks about things or portrays things, what is it actually talking about? So obviously the original trilogy, as depicted by George Lucas, is, and I say, you know, obviously, to a degree, this kind of surprises some people. And I'm saying, obviously, from, you know, the fact I've submersed myself in the literature for the past 3 years or so, is an anti-American Vietnam film. The rebels are the Viet Cong, and the Galactic Empire is the United States military in Vietnam. And it's a film about kind of technological fascism crushing freedom fighters. That's the original Star Wars trilogy. But Star Wars is so much more than the cinema. You know, it's the whole expanded universe. It's the books, it's the comics, it's the games. And scholarship has tended to just focus on the films, which is fine because, you know, there's loads to say about the films. There's loads to say about the prequels. There's loads to say about the new trilogy. But the world of Star Wars has always been so much more. And in the 1990s, you know, the prequel trilogies don't start until 1999. You get hundreds of books and comics and computer games, all of which are talking about real world history, but in different ways. They're talking about the collapse of the Soviet Union and America emerging as the world's great superpower. and they're talking about the Rwandan genocide and the massacre at Srebrenica, and then the 9/11 happens, and they're talking about George W. Bush and the war on terror, and you get that in the prequels as well. So the book is basically examining how Star Wars repurposes the history that's happening at the time to talk about the things that he wants to talk about. And so today, even before we've been recording this, I've been finishing off my chapter on the Galactic Empire, because the argument that I make in the book is the Galactic Empire is the most important long-running institution or reference point in the entirety of Star Wars. Everything else can largely stay the same. It's the Empire, it's the portrayal of fascism that is constantly evolving through Star Wars to always make it relevant. You get the fascism of the original trilogy, which uses Nazi imagery to talk about America. You get the fascism of the prequel trilogy, which talks about George W. Bush utilizing the global war on terror for his own nefarious political purposes. You get the fascism of the sequel trilogy, which is all about kind of Nazis escaping to Argentina and then coming back to wreak havoc again, but set in the age, as it then turns out, the age of Trump, and the age of kind of burgeoning authoritarianism around the world, not just in America, but in Europe and in Russia and in South America as well. So Star Wars is constantly reacting and repurposing everything that's going on at the time. And, you know, sometimes it will use, you know, a guy in what looks like a Nazi uniform to talk about it. But it's probably talking about something that just happened very, very recently. And the books and the comics and the games often had such a quick turnaround, and the authors of them had so much freedom, that they're talking about stuff almost in real time. You know, you're maybe 6 months to a year after something happens, it starts to appear in a book or a novel or a comic, which is fast in the world of publishing. And that's the aim of the book, to look at all of these different things and say, you know, it doesn't matter if, you know, this book isn't canon anymore. At the time that it came out, when, you know, this book is talking about a horrible race of aliens that kind of stormed in and horribly tortured everybody and committed a massacre, and, you know, the galaxy couldn't stop them, the military was slow to do anything, and the Jedi just stood and watched by. It's like, well, it came out just after the Rwandan genocide. Is it possible that it might be talking about the Rwandan genocide? And similar with, if your listeners have kind of read the New Jedi Order series that deal with a race called the Yuuzhan Vong, who invade the galaxy and were originally modelled on the Aztecs. They're a group of religious fanatics who torture people and they commit human sacrifices, but they are constantly in praise to their gods, and they view everybody who isn't part of them as being infidels, as a civilization to be exterminated. And that might have been how they started off being portrayed, but the book that deals with the fall of Coruscant, which is the kind of the galactic capital, which is created by crashing ships full of civilians into the planetary shields until they collapse, and then buildings start exploding and falling down, comes out in October 2001. I reckon after that point, the image that the readers have of the Yuuzhan Vong after 9/11 is very, very different to how it was originally intended. You know, that's a coincidence for Star Wars, but you begin to see that manifested through the books. So, you know, the world has changed as we were writing these. And I find all of that just endlessly interesting and endlessly fascinating. But some of it is murky and a little distasteful. Some of the things I suspect you were suggesting in the lead into this question, that some of the politics at Star Wars at times can be on the dubious side, particularly in regards to some of its racial politics and some of its depiction of stereotypes and the like, can be difficult. And again, you know, it's possible to critique that type of stuff from a standing point of, you know, this is interesting, but we should probably flag up, you know, some of the ways this is really quite problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That was a great sort of, makes me want to read the book, I guess, which is what you need, right?
Mission accomplished.
So is there like a publication date on that, or is still kind of fuzzy?
Well, depending on the speed of academic publishing, so what will happen is I will submit this book at the end of the month. It will go out to peer review. That could take weeks, it could take months. If they come back and go, You've done it, Chris. Well done. What a winner. Don't even change a comma. I will die of surprise because that's never going to happen. But then there'll be a kind of a deadline of, you know, getting some edits and that done. So, you know, there is a possibility that this book comes out before the end of the year. If not, it will probably be early next year. But it's not off in the far and distant past anymore, as it has been for a while. I mean, the only reason this happened is I damn near killed myself over the previous month, writing what I think ended up being close to 60,000 words in 30 days to get it done and get it finished. And, you know, that broke me in virtually every conceivable way. But it now means it's nearly a thing.
As a person who writes many words every week, that is still many, many, many words in a month.
It was, I wouldn't recommend it. You know, sometimes you've got to do what you've got to do when it comes to writing, but I wouldn't recommend it. It was a decision taken out of necessity. And also, this is the only clear month that I'm likely to get for the entirety of this year. If I don't use it for this right now, then this book's never going to get finished. So, you know, I took it and then I got tired and I fell down and now I'm back.
Okay, so maybe book some point in the near or distant future. Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, if people are interested in other bits and pieces, something that I definitely know is coming out in October is an official Star Wars book that I helped write called Star Wars Battles That Changed the Galaxy, which actually is a military history of the Star Wars universe. I wrote it alongside some actually, you know, proper Star Wars authors like Amy Radcliffe and Cole Horton and Jason Fry. And it's basically kind of looking at, you know, the Battle of Endor and then analyzing it like a military historian would do, but all set as if it was in universe. And that was just the most wonderful, geeky thing I've ever had the joy of doing. It made every single one of my Christmases. All I've ever wanted to do as a Star Wars fan was to, you know, get the opportunity to play a little bit in the world, and the outcome of it is it's a really, really beautiful thing. So if people are interested in Star Wars books and they want to kind of read something like that, then you should definitely buy that when it comes out in October.
The name for that book will be in the show notes if you're curious. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining me here today and chatting about, you know, First World War computer games and Star Wars.
Thank you very much for having me on. I've got no idea how much editing you're going to need to pare this down into something that's actually kind of listenable for a human audience, but I've had a lot of fun.
As I tell most of my guests, I don't do any editing.
Hooray!
Goodbye, Piccadilly!